You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, find out how you can save money on energy bills by planting trees and shrubs this spring. First, the Milwaukee suburbs are seeing a growing number of jobs that aren't being quickly filled. A new report from the Milwaukee-based Public Policy Forum suggests that the barrier to filling those positions might be transportation. The report looks at Milwaukee's last mile problem. That's when public transit doesn't quite get people where they need to go. Joe Pietrangelo joins us now. He's a senior researcher at the Public Policy Forum in Milwaukee. Joe, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, as I understand it, for transportation planners, the last mile problem is kind of a holy grail, finding a solution to it. Can you talk about what we mean when we say the last mile problem?
Yeah, this is not a new problem by any means. It's essentially that many places it's just difficult to run a bus because the demand is relatively low, so people can get relatively close to their job or other destination, for example, but can't quite get all the way there. So that's where that last mile gap we call the last mile problem.
So you have to find that way to get from home to the bus, say, or bus to the work, and
exactly.
It's more than a convenient short walk.
Correct.
And as I read the report, this last mile problem is actually maybe a jobs issue, not just a transportation issue. How is this a limiter for connecting people with jobs?
Right. Well, like in the Milwaukee area, for example, we've had a lot of job growth in the suburbs in recent years, and the projections are also that at least half the jobs are going to be out in suburban areas. So the question is, how can we connect the workers where we have the largest workforce in the city and also the most unemployment in the city with those jobs as they come along, especially going forward where the projections are that so many jobs are going to be opening and or just coming available because the baby boomers are retiring, that we need to really utilize our workforce as much as we can. And a big part of that is just breaking down barriers like transportation.
I mean, is there transportation, even setting aside the last mile problem, are there buses that run from the ballpark of where these unemployed workers are in Milwaukee to the general neighborhood of where these jobs are opening up in the outskirts and in the suburbs?
Yeah, well, we have a variety of places in Milwaukee. And there are transit routes that go out to the suburbs, but there are places of where, for example, you can get to the inner suburbs, but then some of the jobs are just a little further, like the next ring of suburbs. So we have also a challenge where we don't have regional cooperation, so a lot of routes end at the county border, and you know, obviously jobs and development don't end at the county border, so you end up with that gap happening in a lot of places right along the edge of the county.
Talking to Joe Pietrangelo with the Public Policy Forum, lead author of a report on connecting people, unemployed people, often in Milwaukee, with jobs, often in the suburbs and beyond, how to figure out how to fix gaps in public transit in particular to connect those two, the workers and the jobs. And that's the bulky report. Let's get into that, Joe. What kind of things are you looking at to fill in the gaps here?
Yeah, we looked at several things. One common strategy that we saw around the country is flexible forms of transit. So this is where a transit system provides transit routes in smaller vehicles, usually small buses or vans, and the routes are, there's flexibility built into the routes so people can request to be picked up or dropped off in a spot that's not exactly on the route. In some cases, the services are even fully on demand, so it's just based on requests being made by phone or through mobile apps that allow the buses to or the vans to navigate to a wider range of locations where there's again, the demand is lower, but there is demand. So that's one way that transit systems are doing it themselves. We also see a lot of transit systems partnering with taxi companies and ride-hailing companies like Lyft and Uber to provide even smaller-scale individual rides to those lower density areas. And that's often done by subsidizing the rides as long as they connect with transit and stay within a limited designated area.
And then in both of these cases, it isn't I'm hopping on the van at my front door and getting to the front door of the workplace or taking this ride share or a cab from one to the other. It's connecting me with maybe from the bus to that workplace. Is that right?
Right, exactly. So transit systems might designate a certain area a couple miles around a transit stop and say, we'll subsidize rides that stay within this zone, for example. And as you said, it is these types of things are being used in other places for suburban residents who live in a place that's not served by transit to connect them to the transit system. But in our case in Milwaukee, it's mainly an issue of people taking a bus out and wanting to get further and get to locations where the bus doesn't go.
Your report also talks about using smartphone apps, maybe devising a smartphone app to make it kind of a seamless connection between the bus and whatever other alternatives are out there.
Yeah, in Milwaukee, we have had a lot of developments recently with technology. We have a real-time website where people can track buses in real time. But what we don't have is a mobile app that, you know, where you can pay for service, you can track buses, plan trips, all of it through one app. And not only do other transit systems have those types of apps, but they're starting to integrate last-mile services, like integrating in a ride-hailing app like Lyft or Uber, or integrating in a bike share system app to make it easy for people to take trips that involve the bus, but also another last-mile service as well.
Any other innovative transit ideas that are in the report that I haven't asked about yet?
Well, I mentioned bike share. There's a lot of coordination happening. There's a little bit of that in Milwaukee, but in other places we see even more coordination between bike share systems and transit systems to co-locate bike share stations near busy bus stops. So that's one thing that we see. In Milwaukee County with biking, we also have bike racks on all the buses. That's something that hasn't extended to the suburbs and could be helpful as well. And then a last thing we have in Milwaukee, we have shared ride taxi services in some of the suburban counties. Those are publicly operated taxi services, and we're starting to see a little more connection between those and the bus system in Milwaukee County by extending their service area, and we think that holds some promise too. If that can continue.
So you have these ideas here. They're not necessarily just going to evolve by themselves. Do you see a hunger from stakeholders like employers, local and county governments, to sit down and try to make these things a reality?
We do have some traction in certain areas of the city and region. The Menominee Valley is an area right in the heart of the city of Milwaukee that is difficult to get to by transit, and employers in that area actually identified this as a key issue that they want to work on. So they're doing some additional analysis there, trying to get employer and employee feedback, and we think that there could be some experimentation with business involvement there. And then out in Waukesha County, there's also been a lot of engagement on this from the political leadership getting interested in this issue as they see the job growth and the projections as a crucial issue going forward. So we also have here in Milwaukee a regional transit leadership council that was formed recently as a public-private organization that is discussing these issues. So that's a venue where we think there could be momentum on perhaps developing some sort of pilot.
And regional transportation, as you mentioned, we don't always do that well at that. In Wisconsin, we've actually kind of limited the power of regional transit authorities to do things. Are there state laws in place? Are there ways that cooperation can happen effectively?
Yeah, unfortunately, we do not have a regional transit authority, but what we think could happen is there could be greater cooperation between counties, just in at least in individual services. Like, for example, in Milwaukee, we have a lot of suburbs just outside of Milwaukee County. If we wanted to improve transit services, that would help both Milwaukee County residents and the employers in those suburban communities, the counties could work together to create a funding solution jointly. We also see across the country, suburban municipalities are getting involved as well. So there could be, you know, intergovernmental cooperation that can break down some of these regional barriers we have here.
We'll leave it there, Joe. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Joe Pietrangelo, senior researcher at the Public Policy Forum, a nonprofit research organization in Milwaukee. He joined us to talk about a new report that looks at challenges Milwaukee area commuters face when fixed public transit routes stop short of getting them to work.
If you're making your yard and garden plans for this year, our next guest says that you can get some surprising benefits to your energy bill. In a recent piece on WisConText, he says trees and shrubs planted in the right places can lower heating and cooling costs.
Vijay Pandian joins us now. He's a horticultural agent and educator for the University of Wisconsin Extension, Brown County. His WisContext piece is linked on the Central Time Facebook page. Vijay, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me, Rob. Appreciate it.
So how much, before we get into specifics, how much can we save on our energy bills if we're really smart about planting trees and shrubs?
Well, you know, the rising energy cost is actually an issue for many homeowners. Say, if we do modify our landscape, we can actually save about 25% to 30% actually on our heating and cooling cost, like placing some trees and shrubs on the south side of a house, or maybe having some windbreak trees on the northwest side, or maybe even having some like dwarf shrubs around the foundation of the house. All these things actually have some major impact in reducing our energy costs.
And does this have to be kind of a long-term plan thing? Because trees take, you know, 10 years, 20 years sometimes to get big enough, I would think, to make a difference.
Absolutely. Trees can live actually beyond our generations. And so certainly, you know, when you're designing our landscape, you need to think about the future. And, you know, the long-term benefits are there quite a bit. And in the short term, you may not be able to reap them right away. Say, probably I'm talking about like 10 years from now, something like that, if the homeowners start to design the landscape right now.
And speaking of timing, I mean, are these mostly things that we can get out and plant in the spring, so we should be making these plans right now?
Absolutely. Say, you know, with the spring around the corner right now, in many local nurseries and, you know, garden centers, it's so many of the trees and shrubs, say, many of the tree species are pretty native to Wisconsin. You can easily get them, like from white pine, Austrian pine, Norway spruce, your eastern red cedar trees. These are excellent evergreen trees to be planted as a windbreak. And you can plant some, like, you know, shrubs too, actually. These shrubs play an excellent role in blocking some of the snow drift. Say, like for Radocia dogwoods, black chokeberry, nine bark, hazelnut, American cranberry bush, viburnum. These are excellent in a native shrub species, and you can plant them too. And like for shading purpose, like you can have some oak trees, Kentucky coffee trees, honey locust trees. These are, again, native species too. And they do provide a lot of shade to a house. So I think those are excellent tree species to have in our yard.
And what about digging a little deeper into that, the heat loss problem that is a problem, insulation with a lot of homes here in Wisconsin? What can we do about keeping that hot air in the house? It seems like, how would a tree help? It's outside the house, but you say it actually can make a difference.
Well, that's a very good question. And in the wintertime, it's always a huge issue when you have actually an open yard or an open lot. And when the winter wind constantly hits it, actually, we lose the heat quite a bit. Say, to prevent that and to contain the heat inside of a house, you need to have a windbreak trees. Say, a windbreak trees, you plant them in a staggered rows of like a two rows in a staggered fashion. And when you have those evergreen trees, they block those winter winds. And that will really help in conserving the heat inside of a house. Now, the other smart thing you can also do is that to give some good insulation to our foundation of the house, actually, and you can plant some like a dwarf compact shrubs, like some dwarf conifers. A lot of times there are a lot of dwarf varieties of shrubs that you can plant nearby the foundation, and that helps in a little bit in cooling, conserving the heat inside our house too.
Talking to Vijay Pandian, horticulture agent and educator for UW Extension Brown County. I want to invite your calls, actually, if you have a question about what kind of shrub or tree you can plant in your yard, or shrubs and trees you can plant in your yard to help save on energy bills, or let us know if you've done this, if you've had that 10-year plan and are reaping the benefits now. You could call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. 1234. Vijay, you were just talking about planting dwarf varieties along the foundation. I know you want them kind of close, but how close is too close to the house for those little guys?
That's an excellent question. A lot of times I do see people planting like 1 feet, 2 feet away from the foundation. That's not a good idea, actually, to have those in a shrub that too close to the foundation. Keep it about like in a 4 or 5 feet away from the foundation of the house, okay? Because you also have to think about these dwarf shrubs do tend to grow over time, actually. You know, it's not going to be staying tiny, teeny bit. Say they will tend to, you know, expand a little bit, about 3-4 feet, you know, or 4 or 5 feet spread about, and can get about like, you know, 4 or 5 feet above the ground. Say, and also think about, you know, spacing those shrubs. Always consider how mature these shrubs going to get, and based on that, give a proper spacing for them. So don't plant them too close, actually, from one apart the other. So many times you can plant like an alpine currant. You can plant some like in a dwarf mugo pines. So these are some shrubs that you can plant around the foundation of the house.
And we're almost getting to the warmer part of the year here, summer, when we care a lot about not letting the house get too hot. And I guess the pavement sort of soaks up a lot of heat. What can we do to stop some of that heat from bouncing back and making our houses warmer?
Well, a lot of time in the hot summertime, like in July, August, you know, if you do have like a sidewalk, driveways, or your hardscapings, they absorb too much heat, actually, and they radiate back them again to our walls or to our windows, and makes our house a little more furthermore warmer. Say, to create a little bit of a pleasant surrounding around our house, especially near to the pavements and driveways, you can plant some hedges. And these hedges will help in cooling, you know, the air around them. Say, like typical hedges that we use in our landscape, it goes from like boxwoods, yews, your upright junipers, alpine currants, nine box, dogwoods. These are excellent hedges that you can use in your landscape.
And Vijay, I've got to mention, I've got a couple of small dead trees in my backyard because I didn't rabbit-proof them. Are there particular kinds of trees that you're looking at that we need to take special care of, especially through the winter when creatures want to nibble on the bark?
I mean, like a hungry deer and a rabbit, they can chew on any kind of trees and shrubs. And for them, the young trees and shrubs are more vulnerable to the damage. Say, perhaps in late fall, maybe if you want to put up like a hardwood cloth or a chicken wire around them, and that might help in preventing those, you know, bunnies from, you know, chewing those bark. Especially the young ones. But as the tree becomes, or the shrub becomes so mature, they don't do that much of damage to the trunk of the tree, perhaps maybe to the branches, if the branches are low-lying. Say, I think that seems to be the more, gives a foolproof way of protecting from the bunnies.
And when you talk about, you know, building a hedge, that could be a lot of plants we're talking about, which could mean your bank account takes a hit. Are there cost-effective ways to do this?
If you think about those hedges, you know, you plant them about like, you know, giving them a spacing of like, you know, a couple of feet from one plant to another plant. And if you do have a long pavement, perhaps, you're right, it could be a little bit, expensive. So in those cases, perhaps you can try actually, putting some, mulches, having some grasses underneath, okay? They may also help you out, actually, in giving a little bit of a cooling effect, especially around your, hardscaping pieces.
And, Vijay, how much does this vary? I mean, Wisconsin's a big place. How much does our choice of a tree or shrub vary from south to north, near the lakes and away from the lakes?
Well, that's a very good question. You need to take into consideration, the zone of cold hardiness for these trees and shrub species that you're going to select. So in Wisconsin, we do have three different zones. Say people living actually nearby the lake areas from Michigan, probably they might be in the south side. They might be more into zone 5B, 5A. People living in central part of Wisconsin maybe in zone 4, and people living in further up in north zone 3. So the zone of cold hardiness is a key factor before you're choosing actually these plants. And plus, you need also think about if there is any microclimatic conditions. Say, if you're having a house in a low-lying area, way too close to a pond, so perhaps they have some microclimatic conditions too. Say, you may need to, check into the USDA cold hardiness zone map and take into consideration, these hardiness of those tree and shrub species.
We'll leave it there. Vijay, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome, sir. Thank you so much for inviting me.
We've been talking to Vijay Pandian, horticultural agent and educator for UW Extension Brown County. We've got his piece. It's a WisConText piece on shrubs, trees, and energy conservation. You can find a link to that over on our Central Time Facebook page. President Trump signed an executive order today aimed at lifting or reducing government regulations nationwide on energy companies, coal companies in particular.
With today's executive action, I am taking historic steps to lift the restrictions on American energy, to reverse government intrusion, and to cancel job-killing regulations.
Many of the regulations that are being rolled back came from the Obama administration and were put into place to take steps at slowing down climate change.
Alex Guillen joins us now to talk about the executive order and the impact it might have. He's an energy reporter for Politico, where he also covers the Environmental Protection Agency. Alex, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, there's a lot in this executive order. How much of this is stuff that can take effect quickly? How much of this is stuff that's kind of guidance for changes that could be made down the road?
When you're talking about things that can happen quickly, like within a couple of weeks, only a couple of these items fall under that umbrella. The biggest one there is a moratorium that was imposed last year on new coal leases on federal land, which is important because about 40% of all coal in the U.S. is mined on federal land, primarily out west in Wyoming and a few other states. That was imposed by what's called a secretarial order and can be lifted by another secretarial order that we're expecting Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke to sign tomorrow. It's not clear that had a huge effect over the last year because a lot of coal companies have the leases in hand that they'll need for the future, but it's certainly something they did not want to see continue for the next few years, so that'll be good news for them. A lot of the other stuff, though, is going to be longer-term regulatory changes. It takes the president a few minutes to sign an order telling agencies to roll back these regulations, but they have to go through a notice and comment process that's very similar to what they had to go through to write these rules in the first place. That process can take years, and then you're talking about litigation from environmental groups after that, would could eat up the entire 4 years of his first term.
And one big item in that category, the Clean Power Plan, passed by the Obama administration, or put into place, I should say, by the Obama administration. What, first of all, remind us what the Clean Power Plan would have done.
It set a goal across the United States of reducing carbon emissions from the power sector, from the existing power plants in the U.S., by 32% by 2030. We were already partway to that goal because of the baseline year used. But it set targets for each state for what they had to do. That rule was issued in 2015, or early last year, actually right before Justice Antonin Scalia died. It was one of his last acts. The Supreme Court issued a 5-4 stay of the rule in a very unusual, unprecedented action. And it's been playing through litigation ever since, and there's a court here in D.C. that could rule on it at any day. Now the Justice Department is going to go to the court and say, we've decided we want to rescind this rule, and you should send it back to us without ruling on it.
So it hasn't actually really been in effect yet because of it's been tied up in court?
No, it never took effect.
And so now what is the Trump administration trying to do with the Clean Power Plan?
So their big thing is they're going to, like I said, the first step is to go to the Justice Department and have them go to the court. They represent EPA in this matter, of course, and say, we've reconsidered, we think this rule is unlawful. You should just send it back to us for reworking. The court might do that. The court might not do that. It's sort of up to them. They could just issue a ruling on the regulation. That could lead to a whole sticky mess of legal battles as environmentalists in states like California and New York seek to defend the rule, even though EPA won't be doing that anymore. Then they'll go through a process to repeal that rule in which they'll have to justify why it needs to be repealed. And likely, at the moment at least, they'll have to then come up with some sort of alternative. So it's very early days on what that possibility is, and there's a lot of politics and policy floating around on this issue, so it's very unclear what's going to happen there.
We're talking to Alex Guillen from Politico. He's an energy reporter there looking at executive order from President Trump today, reversing lots of Obama-era climate change-related and energy-related executive actions, secretarial actions, things like that. Coal seems to be a common theme for a lot of this, Alex. The Clean Power Plan, one of the ways that states could have met their obligations was to replace coal-burning power plants, not build new ones. You mentioned the coal leases. The president was standing with coal miners when he did this. He's been promising to bring back coal jobs. Looking at what he did today, are coal mining jobs going to come back as a result?
It's possible we'll see some increase in coal mining jobs. But most people, including a lot of people in the coal mining industry, say that, you know, the dominance that coal used to have 30, 40 years ago is gone and can't be retrieved. A big part of that is because over the last 10 years of the hydraulic fracking technique that was that became very economical and helped drive the natural gas boom, made natural gas very cheap. And so we've seen a lot of switch over from coal to natural gas in recent years. And that's not the kind of thing that's going to change in the near term. So a lot of people at best are just hoping that the coal industry stays at about where it is right now. Jobs are always being lost to automation, though. But they're hoping that no longer jobs will be lost to regulation.
A lot of people are watching for today wondering, what about Paris and the Paris Climate Agreement that the United States signed on to? Did this executive order change anything when it comes to that agreement?
The order did not touch on the Paris Climate Agreement. The White House says it is still discussing internally what to do about that. It was part of the president's campaign trail promises to, at the very least, pull out of that deal, and possibly to renegotiate it somehow, although renegotiating with almost 200 other countries who have been doing this for years and years and are pretty set on the agreement seems difficult at best. So the order doesn't touch on that because there's still a lot of talk going on behind the scenes. Some key people who are advocating for staying in the agreement to preserve the United States' international reputation, you might say, our Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, who, of course, was formerly the CEO of ExxonMobil, and Ivanka Trump, the president's daughter, who has been open about advocating on some of these climate issues. We'll see what kind of success she has with her father.
That said, a lot of our commitments under that Paris Agreement, a lot of what's being reduced today or turned around today was part of the effort to meet the obligations we made under that Paris Agreement. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. The Clean Power Plan was a major part of getting to the cuts we promised.
And then I wanted to ask you about just the general tone toward the concept of climate change, things we haven't touched on. As I understand it, this executive order says, hey, government agencies, stop looking at the impact of climate change. Stop weighing the impact of carbon when you're looking at different individual plans, reviewing applications for permits, that sort of thing. What is the attitude toward climate change in this new executive order?
So the order makes it clear that when agencies are taking actions in writing regulations or approving projects or anything else, that it should primarily be focused on promoting American energy independence, which is sort of a controversial term, but it means domestic energy production, essentially, and of course, the energy jobs that come with that. There's a lot of talk in there about not doing anything unnecessary under the law, the implication being that action on climate change is unnecessary. And the White House has been pretty clear about how it feels about climate change. The budget director, Mick Mulvaney, said recently that the government doesn't want, the Trump administration doesn't want to spend any more money on climate change because it's considered a waste of taxpayer dollars.
We're talking to Alex Guillen right now. He's an energy reporter at Politico. He also covers the Environmental Protection Agency. He's with us to talk about executive orders that President Trump signed today, removing a lot of regulations on energy, climate change, emissions, and more.
And you can join the conversation. What do you think of this move from the Trump administration? Do you think that these regulations should be cut, or are you worried about the impact of the effect against climate change? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're continuing our conversation about President Trump's newest executive order, which undoes many environmental protection mandates put in place during President Obama's administration. Alex Guillen is with us. He's an energy reporter for Politico, where he also covers the Environmental Protection Agency.
And you can join the conversation. What do you think about the rollbacks and regulations today? What concerns you more, the economy or the environment? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
President Trump wasn't alone in this announcement. He was joined by cabinet members, including the head of the Environmental Protection Agency, Scott Pruitt. Pruitt spoke today as well about the executive order. Here's what he had to say.
The president, by his signature today, is rejecting the narrative that this country cannot be both pro-energy and pro-environment. We have done that throughout our history. We can actually achieve good jobs, good growth, and pro-energy policies at the same time of protecting our environment. And the president is sending that message by his signature today on this executive order. But number two, he's also setting a pathway forward, a journey to say that we're no longer going to have regulatory assault on any given sector of our economy. That's going to end by the signing of this executive order. We're not going to allow regulations here at the EPA to pick winners and losers.
So a couple points there, Alex. First of all, could still be pro-environment. As I understand it, this is an effort in part to refocus the EPA on clean air and clean water and not so much the climate change anymore. Is that right?
That is what they talk about, yeah. I think it's probably just worth noting that the language that Scott Pruitt used there, at least the first part of it, where he talks about being pro-growth and pro-economy and pro-environment, that's roughly the same language that was used by Obama administration officials, because they always argued that these regulations would actually in the long term help the economy via public health benefits and, of course, by going after climate change. But yes, the Trump administration has talked about continuing to protect clean air and clean water. What remains to be seen is what that means exactly, because, of course, carbon dioxide is considered a pollutant. Interestingly, EPA took the heaviest cut of all agencies under the administration's early proposed budget. That's not something Congress is going to go along with to that extent. It was a 31% cut, including cuts to major grant programs that are liked across the board. But it's an indication that the administration is not a big fan of EPA.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Cedric with us in Oshkosh. Hi.
Hi.
What do you think?
I feel that the environment needs to be protected. We're not going to protect it by taking away rules that have been worked on and intelligently put in place. You go to some of the foreign countries, for example, China, when the Olympics were there, they had to shut down all the manufacturing in town so that people could survive around there and breathe. And the more we go back into the fossil fuels and things like that, it's going to just dirty up the environment.
Cedric, thanks for the call. What reaction are we hearing from environmental groups, Alex, to this signing of this executive order today?
To say that they're not happy would be understating it significantly. They've all panned this action greatly. Obviously, it's been known since the election that this sort of thing was going to happen. But the big complaint is that this represents a major setback on climate action at a time when scientists are warning time is running out to take action, reduce emissions now, and stave off the worst effects of climate change down the road.
Cedric, thanks for that call. And he mentioned going back to fossil fuels, and Scott Pruitt in that clip we played of the EPA talked about picking winners and losers. I wanted to talk about the energy industry and alternative energy. The Obama administration tried to prioritize alternative energy to the extent that it could. Is that something that's going to change under this new executive order?
No, it doesn't directly address renewable energy. In fact, it says it promotes renewable energy as a source of energy and jobs when appropriate. But clearly the Trump administration thought that the Obama administration's rules were designed to promote renewable energy over coal and other fossil fuels. In certain senses, that's true and that's the effective outcome. But, of course, the Obama administration approached this with the lens of climate change. We've seen over the last 8 years, we've seen really impressive growth from the wind industry and from the solar industry. Whether that growth is sustainable, we'll see. There are key tax credits that at the moment at least are in place through 2020. And of course it's also worth noting that while we have seen really very good growth from both of those industries, they still each represent a fairly small portion of the U.S. electric grid. I think wind makes up 4 to 5% of the total U.S. grid, with a lot of that being concentrated more in the Midwest area and places like Texas. And solar, I believe, makes up less than 1% of our electricity.
And that's only electricity. That's not even counting, say, transportation.
Exactly.
Talking to Alex Guillen, energy reporter for Politico, looking at President Trump's signing of an executive order today reversing many Obama-era climate, energy, environment regulations. We'll go back to our callers now with Jason on the line in Sheboygan. Jason, hi.
Hi. It's a great afternoon. I love the show. I'm a safety professional, occupational safety and health, and what we are looking at is just an increase of the opium epidemic. I mean, hillbilly heroin, oxycodone, is known to be a problem in the coal industry because those jobs are hurting and killing people. And Trump wants to roll back the job-killing regulations and put back in place the people-killing jobs.
Jason, thanks for the call. I don't know if, Alex, you have stats on drug addiction related to coal mining, but there are concerns about the impact of coal production and use on health, the health of Americans. Is that something that is being factored in here?
Yeah, I mean, on the opioid epidemic, I'm not very familiar with that, but it is true that West Virginia coal mining communities are among some of the worst hit across the United States on that issue. As for, you were asking about coal jobs, right?
Coal jobs and the impact of coal on health is what he was getting at, I think. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So, when you're talking more broadly about public health, this is where it becomes sort of a difficult issue for some folks to really wrap their minds around, because, of course, you know, when you're talking about public health benefits you gain from these regulations, it's also nebulous. You're talking about a coal-fired power plant being shut down here, and that leads to less instances of asthma and hospitalizations there. And obviously, scientists have made those connections, and they're very well established. But improving public health would be an important part of shutting down these coal jobs.
Let's go back to our callers. Randy is with us in Kewaskum. Randy, hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Actually, the Obama administration really didn't go and work things out and make a real good balance. They really he didn't care about business. It was let's kiss up the environmental extremists as much as possible. We don't care about the law diminishing returns. We're getting to a point where we're pushing these settings so low that we aren't really getting any real benefit out of it. So what? We look good. And that's where he stood. And there was no balance there. It's like, how far to the extreme can we go?
Randy, thanks a lot for the call. Alex, do we have a sense of how much Obama-era regulations affected energy businesses negatively?
It's certainly true that coal jobs are down over the last 8 years. And that includes coal went from just under 50% of the U.S. electric mix down to more like a third, about 32%, I believe, over the last 8 years, which is a pretty incredible shift. Regulations are not the only reason we saw that happening. Part of that was a slowdown in electricity demand because of the Great Recession. Part of that was because of increased automation at mines. Part of that was because coal is getting more expensive to reach. We've mined the easiest and cheapest to get coal. So this is always a problem when it comes to government regulations is there's always the potential for job loss, particularly, yes, in coal mining with these Obama regulations.
And, Alex, as we start to wrap up, a lot of the big story in energy seems like the rise of natural gas, especially with natural gas fracking in the country. And that's a part, as I understand it, of what's putting coal out of business more and more. Is that something that's being taken into account in these debates and this action today?
It's sort of interesting because, President Trump has talked about really boosting coal numbers, but he also wants more natural gas. And then in the United States, at least, those are in competition for electricity. And that's why that's a large part of why coal has suffered in the past few years. It'll be interesting to see what happens on the international market, whether we've already, for a few years now, since the fracking boom, we have been on a path toward starting to export natural gas. It takes a while to get the infrastructure required for that up and running. So a lot of permits have been approved in recent years, and we'll start seeing that happening soon. We're also starting to export more coal. So we have quite a lot of energy resources here in the U.S. already, and President Trump is talking about even further increasing those.
We'll leave it there for now. Alex, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
Alex Guillen is an energy reporter for Politico. He also covers the Environmental Protection Agency. He joined us today to talk about President Trump's executive order rolling back a lot of climate change regulations.